20. Nasun, faceted. But also, I listen through the earth. I hear the reverberations. When a new key is cut, her bittings finally ground and sharpened enough that she can connect to the obelisks and make them sing. We all know of it. Those of us who hope seek out that singer. We are forever barred from turning the key ourselves, but we can influence its direction. Whenever an obelisk resonates, you may be sure that one of us lurks nearby. We talk. This is how I know. In the dead of the night, Nasun wakes. It's dark in the barracks still, so she's careful not to step on the creakier floorboards as she pulls on her shoes and jacket and makes her way across the room. None of the others stirs, if they even wake and notice. They probably just think she has to go to the outhouse. Outside, it's quiet. The sky is beginning to lighten with dawn in the east, though it's harder to tell now that the ash clouds have thickened. She goes to the top of the downhill path and notices a few lights on in Jackety. Some of the farmers and fishers are up. In Found Moon, though, all is still. What is it that tugs at her mind? The feel of it is irritating, gummy, as if something is caught in her hair and needs to be yanked free. The sensation is centered in her sesapine. No, deeper. This tugs at the light of her spine, the silver between her cells, the threads that bind her to the ground, and to Found Moon, and to Shafa, and to the sapphire that hovers just above the clouds of Jekity, visible now and again when the clouds break a little. The irritation is, it is north. Something is happening up north. Nasun turns to follow the sensation, climbing the hill up to the crucible mosaic, and stopping at its center as the wind makes her hair puffs shiver. Up here she can see the forest that surrounds Jekity spread before her like a map, rounded treetops and occasional outcroppings of ribbon basalt. Part of her can perceive shifting forces, reverberating lines, connections, amplification. But of what? Why? Something immense.
What you perceive is the opening of the obelisk gate, says Steele.
She is unsurprised to find him suddenly standing beside her. More than one obelisk? Nasun asks, because that's what she's assessing, lots more.
Every one stationed above this half of the continent. 100 parts of the great mechanism beginning to work again as they were meant to.
Steele's voice, baritone and surprisingly pleasant, sounds wistful in this moment. Nasun finds herself wondering about his life, his past, whether he has ever been a child like her. That seems impossible.
So much power. The very heart of the planet is channeled through the gate, and she uses it for so frivolous a purpose. A faint sigh. Then again, so did its original creators, I suppose.
Somehow, Nasun knows that Steele is talking about her mother with that she. Mama is alive and angry, and full of so much power. What purpose? Nasun makes herself ask. Steele's eyes slide toward her. She has not specified whose purpose she means, her mother's, or those ancient people who first created and deployed the obelisks.
The destruction of one's enemies, of course. A small and selfish purpose that feels great in the moment, though not without consequence.
Nasun considers what she has learned, assessed, and seen in the dead smiles of the other two guardians. Father Earth fought back, she says.
As one does, against those who seek to enslave. That's understandable, isn't it?
Nasun closes her eyes. Yes, it's all so understandable, really, when she thinks about it.
The way of the world isn't the strong devouring the weak, but the weak deceiving and poisoning and whispering in the ears of the strong until they become weak, too. Then it's all broken hands and silver threads, woven like ropes, and mothers who move the earth to destroy their enemies, but cannot save one little boy, girl. There has never been anyone to save Nasun. Her mother warned her there never would be. If Nasun ever wants to be free of fear, she has no choice but to forge that freedom for herself. So she turns slowly to face her father, who stands quietly behind her.
Sweetening, he says.
It's the voice he usually uses for her, but she knows it isn't real. His eyes are cold as the ice she left all over his house a few days ago. His jaw is tight, his body shaking just a little. She glances down at his tight fist. There's a knife in it, a beautiful one made from red opal, her favorite of his more recent work. It has a slight iridescence and a smooth sheen that completely disguises the razor sharpness of its napped edges. Hi, Daddy, she says. She glances towards Steele, who is surely aware of what Jija intends. But the gray stone eater has not bothered to turn away from the pre-dawn forestscape or the northern sky where so many earth-changing things are happening. Very well. She faces her father again. Mama's alive, Daddy. If the words mean anything to him, it doesn't show. He just keeps standing there, looking at her. Looking at her eyes in particular. She's always had her mother's eyes. Suddenly it doesn't matter. Nasun sighs and rubs her face with her hands, as weary as Father Earth must be after so many eternities of hate. Hate is tiring. Nihilism is easier, though she does not know the word, and will not for a few years. It's what she's feeling regardless. An overwhelming sense of the meaninglessness of it all. I think I understand why you hate us, she says to her father as she drops her hands to her sides. I've done bad things, Daddy, like you probably thought I would. I don't know how to not do them. It's like everybody wants me to be bad, so there's nothing else I can be. She hesitates, then says what's been in her mind for months now, unspoken. She doesn't think she'll have another chance to say it. I wish you could love me anyway, even though I'm bad. She thinks of Shafa as she says this, though. Shafa, who loves her no matter what, as a father should. Jija just keeps staring at her. Elsewhere in the silence on that plane of awareness that is occupied by Sistuna and whatever the sense of the silver threads is called, Nasun feels her mother collapse. To be specific, she feels her mother's exertion upon the shifting, glimmering network of obelisks suddenly cease. Not that it ever touched her sapphire. I'm sorry, Daddy, Nasun says at last. I tried to keep loving you, but it was too hard. He's much bigger than her, armed where she is not. When he moves, it is with a mountainous lumber, all shoulders first and bulk and slow build up to unstoppable speed. She weighs barely 100 pounds. She has no real chance. But in the instant that she feels the twitch of her father's muscles, small reverberating shocks against the ground and air, she orients her awareness toward the sky in a single ringing command. The transformation of the sapphire is instantaneous. It causes a concussion of air that rushes inward to fill the vacuum. The sound this makes is the loudest crack of thunder Nasun has ever heard. Jija, in mid-lunge, starts and stumbles, looking up. A moment later, the sapphire slams into the ground before Nasun, cracking the central stone of the crucible mosaic and a 6-foot radius of ground around her. It isn't the sapphire as she's seen it up till now, although the sameness of it transcends things like shape.
when she extends her hand to wrap around the hilt of the long, flickering knife of blue stone, she falls into it a little. Up, flowing through watery facets of light and shadow. In, down into the earth. Out, away, brushing against the other parts of the hole that is the gate. The thing in her hand is the same monstrous, mountainous dynamo of silvery power that it has always been. The same tool, just more versatile now. Gija stares at it, then at her. There is an instant in which he wavers, and Nasun waits. If he turns, runs. He was her father once. Does he remember that time? She wants him to. Nothing between them will ever be the same again, but she wants that time to matter. No. Gija comes at her again, shouting as he raises the knife. So Nasun lifts the sapphire blade from the earth. It's nearly the length of her body, but it weighs nothing. The sapphire floats, after all. It's just floating here in front of her instead of above. She doesn't lift it either, strictly speaking. She wills it to move to a new position, and it does. In front of her. Between her and Gija, so that when Gija angles his body to stab her, he cannot help bumping right into it. This makes it easy, inevitable, for her power to lay into him. She doesn't kill him with ice. Nasun defaults to using the silver instead of orogeny most days. The shift of Gija's flesh is more controlled than what she did to Eight's, largely because she is aware of what she's doing, and also because she's doing it on purpose. Gija begins to turn to stone, starting at the point of contact between him and the obelisk. What Nasun doesn't consider is momentum, which carries Gija forward even as he glances off the sapphire and twists and sees what is happening to his flesh and starts to inhale for a scream. He doesn't finish the inhalation before his lungs are solidified. He does, however, finish his lunge, though it is off balance and out of control, more of a fall than an attack by now. Still, it is a fall with a knife as its focal point, and so the knife catches Nasun in the shoulder. He was aiming for her heart. The pain of the strike is sudden and terrible, and it breaks Nasun's concentration at once. This is bad, because the sapphire flares as her pain does, flickering into its half-real state and back as she gasps and staggers. This finishes Gija in an instant, solidifying him completely into a statue with a frizz of smoky quartz hair and a round red ochre face and clothes of deep blue serendibite, because he wore dark clothing in order to stalk his daughter. This statue stands poised for only an instant, though, and then the flicker of the sapphire sends a ripple through him like a struck bell. Not unlike the concussion of turned inward orogenic force that a guardian once inflicted on a man named Inan. Gija shatters in the same way, just not as wetly. He's brittle stuff, weak, poorly made. The pieces of him tumble into stillness around Nasun's feet. Nasun gazes at the remains of her father for a long, aching moment. Beyond her, in Found Moon and down below in Jekity, lights are coming on in the cabins. Everyone's been woken up by the thunderclap of the sapphire. There is confusion. Voices calling back and forth, frantic sessing and probes of the earth. Steele now gazes down at Gija with her. "It never ends," he says. "It never gets better." Nasun says nothing. Steele's words fall into her like a stone into water, and she does not ripple in their wake. "You'll kill everything you love eventually. Your mother, Shafa, all your friends here in Found Moon. No way around it." She closes her eyes. "No way. Except one." A careful, considered pause. "Shall I tell you that way?" Shafa is coming. She can cess him, the buzz of him, the constant torment of the thing in his brain that he will not let her remove. Shafa, who loves her.
You'll kill everything you love eventually.
Yes, she makes herself say. Tell me how not to. She trails off. She cannot say, hurt them, because she has already hurt so many. She's a monster. But there must be a way for her monstrousness to be contained, for the threat of an origin's existence to be ended.
The moon's coming back, Nasun. It was lost so long ago, flung away like a ball on a paddle string. But the string has drawn it back. Left to itself, it will pass by and fly off again. It's done that before, several times now.
She can see one of her father's eyes, set into a chunk of his face, gazing up at her from amid the pile. His eyes were green, and now they have become a beautiful shade of clouded peridot.
But with the gate, you can nudge it just a little. Adjust its
a soft, amused sound.
The path that the moon naturally follows, instead of letting it pass again, lost and wandering, bring it home. Father Earth's been missing it. Bring it straight here, and let them have a reunion.
Oh. Oh. She understands suddenly why Father Earth wants her dead.
It will be a terrible thing,
Steele says softly, nearly in her ear because he's moved closer to her.
It will end the seasons. It will end every season. And yet, what you're feeling right now, you need never feel again. No one will ever suffer again.
Nasun turns to stare at Steele. He's bent toward her, a look of almost comical slyness chiseled on his face. Then Shafa trots to a stop before them. He's staring at the ruin of Jija, and she sees the moment when the realization of what he's seeing flickers across his face, a mobile shockwave. His ice-white gaze lifts to her, and she searches his expression with her belly clenched against imminent pain. There is only anguish in his face, fear for her, sorrow on her behalf, alarm at her bloodied shoulder. Wariness and protective anger as he focuses on Steele. He is still her Shafa. The ache of Jija fades within the ease of his regard. Shafa will love her no matter what she becomes. So Nasun turns then to Steele and says, tell me how to bring the moon home. This has been a Hachette audio production of The Obelisk Gate, The Broken Earth, Book 2, written by N.K. Jemison, read by Robin Miles, produced and directed by Tommy Harron, post-production by Gabino Reyes. The Obelisk Gate is also available in print and digital formats from Orbit, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette Audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2016 by N.K. Jemison. Audio production copyright 2016 by Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this audiobook without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the audiobook other than for review purposes, please contact permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons living or dead, events or locales is entirely coincidental.